So welcome to this edition of the Panic Away podcast. Today I have a very special guest on the line, Dr. David D. Burns, who is an adjunct clinical professor of psychiatry and behavioral science at the Stanford University School of Medicine and has served as visiting scholar at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Burns has been a pioneer in the development of cognitive behavioral therapy, a drug-free treatment for depression and anxiety, which has become the most widely used and extensively researched form of psychotherapy in the world. Dr. Burns has won numerous research, teaching, and media awards, but is best known for his very successful self-help books such as Feeling Good and The Feeling Good Handbook, which has sold over 5 million copies in the United States alone. In a national survey of American mental health professionals, Dr. Burns' Feeling Good was the top-rated book from a list of 1,000 self-help books for patients suffering from depression. American and Canadian mental health professionals prescribe Feeling Good for their patients more often than any other self-help book. In recent years, more than 50,000 mental health professionals have attended Dr. Burns' training programs throughout the United States and Canada. More than 100 articles about his work have appeared in magazines such as Reader's Digest, Psychology Today, and Ladies' Home Journal. He's been interviewed by numerous radio and television personalities such as Oprah Winfrey, Mike Wallace, and now today the lucky man gets to be in the hot seat with myself, Barry McDonough. Welcome, Dr. Burns.
Well, thank you so much. I'm just delighted to have this chance to shoot the breeze and share a few ideas with your listeners.
Great. You know, just as I was reading that out there, while I was reading your career profile, you must be incredibly proud of what you've achieved to date.
I am pretty excited and pretty amazed. When I wrote Feeling Good, I didn't have any idea that it would become as popular or as widely known or have the impact that it had. My original idea was I was just writing handouts for my patients to read between sessions. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, if I put them together, maybe I could, photocopy 100 copies or something like that and, speed up therapy, just hand them out to patients. And then I was very fortunate to get the book published, and it started out pretty slow, actually. There wasn't any support from the publisher, but it began to spread by word of mouth, and because it had apparently it had antidepressant effects, anti-anxiety effects, and it began to sell more and more, and then over time it eventually got in the top of the bestseller list. It took 8 years after it was published because there was no big publicity push mm-hmm. for it. But I think it has been amazing to me. Yeah, I would have been thrilled to, get 100 copies out there. Yeah. That was my goal.
Yeah, so it's quite something. Well, let's back up a little bit. Can you begin by telling us a little bit about what drives you and why you're so interested in improving people's mental health?
Well, I think what I like to see is dramatic changes in people. Some people say, how can you, not get depressed and drained when you're working all day long with people who are suicidal or hopeless yeah. or depressed or having panic attacks and anxious? And I actually find it exciting because I have the thought, this is a tremendous opportunity to change this person's life, and what an amazing thing it's going to be when the session comes, hopefully soon, where they suddenly go from despair to joy, from tears to laughter in the session. And I've always been looking for powerful new forms of therapy, or trying to develop powerful new forms of therapy to make that experience happen. It's kind of addictive because you can't help another person without helping yourself. You can't hurt another person without hurting yourself. And so when I see that those transformations happening in sessions, and now we're seeing it, very, very frequently, it blows my mind. It's just a fantastic experience. The Buddhists and Christians and a lot of religions, on some level, have said we're all one. Human beings are all one. And you wonder what that means, or the universe is one. It's kind of a mystical concept that doesn't seem to make sense. But in psychotherapy, it sure makes sense, because if I what hurts me the most is making a mistake and hurting a patient. It's just like I feel like I'm getting kicked in the stomach.
Yeah.
You know, every now and then it happens, and then you've got to work that out with the patient. And often you can convert that to a profound and very meaningful experience, but it hurts when it's happening. And by the same token, you can't give someone who's been suffering the gift of joy and self-esteem and confidence and freedom from their fears without giving yourself that same gift at the same time.
Wow. So you develop as the patient progresses, you progress as well.
Yes, yes. That's one of the things that I love about teaching, too, workshops for mental health professionals. I'm teaching them, but I'm learning at the same time. And there's a lot of opportunities for growth, both the people who attend the workshops. They learn professional techniques, but they work on their own healing as well as a way of learning. And I get touched myself in both directions. And at every therapy session, we get feedback at the end of the session, written feedback. At every workshop, I get written feedback from everyone at the end of each day. And I force myself to read the positive and negative comments and look at the ratings and then process mm-hmm. that the next time I see the patient or the next day at the workshop. And I have to face my mistakes and share them as well as find out what I did right that people really loved.
Mm.
So it's an ongoing growth process, and it's both the psychological growth and you could say spiritual growth also, because I think at its deepest level, psychotherapy takes on a kind of spiritual dimension.
Yeah, and you keep yourself very busy. You've schedules, these workshops with therapists right across America and Canada. Sometimes a couple of months, isn't that right?
Yes, I do an awful lot of workshops in the U.S. and Canada. I don't go to Europe or around the world very often because I do so much traveling here, and I love to be home with my wife and our three cats, and we live in California, and it's just you know, joy. I'm just sitting here looking out the window. It's a beautiful sunny day, but I do many 2-day workshops around the United States, and now I'm doing 4-day intensives. I'm going to do one next week. I'll be all week in Vancouver, 4-day intensive, and then the next week I'll be in Edmonton, Canada, doing a four-day intensive, and we go all day long and into the evening. They're 12-hour days, so the people who come have to work really hard personally and learning these what I think are amazing new techniques for the rapid elimination of depression and anxiety, but they're joyous experiences. And so I probably do 25 or at least workshops a year. Mm-hmm. So it keeps me pretty busy. And then I do a lot of teaching at Stanford Medical School too, to psychologists and psychiatrists and young people in training, and just have a tremendous fun with that as well.
Now, the book I want to discuss with you today is your book, When Panic Attacks. Now, even though your book, Feeling Good, is the massive success that it is, I've heard said that you regard When Panic Attacks as your best book. Is that true?
Well, it's certainly, I would say, much better written than my earlier books.
Mm-hmm.
I did get a lot of help with editing from my wife and others, and Feeling Good is pretty well written, but that was 30 years ago when I wrote that, and I've been working at my writing. You know, every day I write just because I love writing, and if you jog every day, you'll get in shape, and if you work at your writing, you'll get better at it. But what really helped me with When Panic Attacks is my daughter. I finally persuaded her to become my editor-in-chief.
Okay.
And so she edited that book with me, and she drove down from San Francisco to our home here about 40 miles south, and every day, and she would edit, and she was a fantastic editor and extremely critical, and she could call me when I'm just coming up with BS. And sometimes I would write a chapter, she'd come down by 10 in the morning, and I'd be all excited about it, and I'd give it to her, and she'd sit down at the dining room table and edit it in an hour. So it's like magic having editing. She'd hand it back to me, like she might write on the first page, "Dad, the best thing I can tell you about this chapter is highlight it in Microsoft Word, hit the delete key, and never try to write this chapter again. It totally sucks." And she was always right. She could pick up on all these corny voices you get into when you're writing. You get so pompous.
Mm.
And But she could also let me know when I was being warm, the things that brought tears to her eyes, the things that brought laughter to her. And I just think to tighten it up and tighten up the writing, say it more quickly, make it readable. I think her touch was just brought the writing. You know, I've always tried to write in a clear way. We all have strengths and faults, and I have a lot of faults. But one thing I'm pretty good at is taking complicated things like how to defeat a panic attack, how to quickly end depression, and to make those concepts very, very simple and clear. And she really facilitated that.
And a great opportunity to be able to work with, you know, on a project with your daughter, spend time with her.
It was amazing. Now she's a mom. She has a 2.5-year-old little guy or grandson. So she's kind of preoccupied with other activities now. Mm. But we spent a good 2-3 years. She helped me edit two books and some other a book also for mental health professionals, several things. And what a joy it was not only to work intellectually with her, but to get close to a family member. You know, to really work through issues and review things from the past and really develop a deep emotional bond. For us, children have been a joy. I was never that close to my parents, unfortunately. It's kind of a sad thing, but my wife and I have both been very blessed by having wonderful ongoing relationships with both our kids. They're both grown now, but it's just like they're still our kids. We see them all the time, and the relationships continue to grow and evolve. We're not talking much about anxiety to your listeners.
Okay, so, well, in When Panic Attacks, you arm the reader with this arsenal of 40 different techniques that can be used to treat their anxiety or depression. And you're a firm believer in getting the reader to find the techniques that work best for them, as everyone is different. Now, you say that if the person finds the right technique or techniques, that recovery can be very fast, very rapid.
Yes, and we see that even more today, I would say, than when I wrote that book. And the high speed of recovery has two different meanings. One meaning is that when people recover, let's say I can give you an example of a woman I treated with 10 years of horrific depression and 4 or 5 panic attacks every week, and she'd had 10 years of unsuccessful treatment. And she recovered in the 5th therapy session over a 5-minute period, but the actual time of her recovery took about 15 seconds. Mm-hmm. When she suddenly went from despair and weeping to uncontrollable laughter, when she suddenly saw through the thoughts that had been the negative thoughts that had been causing her so much misery for 10 years. And so some people think that when people overcome depression or panic or a phobia or whatever it is, that it's a long process that unfolds over years gradually. I've almost never seen that. Almost every patient I've ever treated, the recovery came during the psychotherapy session over, let's say, within a 60-second period.
Wow.
Now, in the past, it used to take weeks or months sometimes to get up to that session when the breakthrough occurs, when you find the technique that works. Now, we're developing super high-speed techniques with my psychotherapy kind of development group at Stanford. And while we can't always make it happen, in many, many cases now, we find that if we sit down with a new patient or a new individual who's suffering and have a 2-hour session rather than this conventional 1-hour once a week thing, if we have a 2-hour session or even the three-hour session, in many instances, we can cause a complete recovery the first time we meet with someone.
Wow.
So this is something I never believed 10 years ago. If you'd said this was possible, I would have said you're a con artist or a snake oil salesman or a faith healer or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're seeing amazing, let's say, evolution in the power of the new psychotherapy techniques we've been developing, and we're seeing things that over and over and over again that are just absolutely mind-blowing. It's a problem for the clinicians I'm working with who are in clinical practice, because they've become so effective that they lose their patience after two or three sessions rather than hanging on to the same patient
for months
or years.
Yeah, of course.
And so they have trouble, you know, keeping their practice full until the word spreads and people finally find out, you know, how great they are, and then they get tons of referrals, so it kind of works out. But we are seeing something, and I would say that this new wave of, you know, super powerful psychotherapy, and it's drug-free also, the same as it was when I wrote Feeling Good. We're not using benzodiazepines, hardly ever, never really, you know, Valium and Xanax and this type of thing. We don't want them, we don't need them anymore, and rarely ever using the antidepressants as well. Just for most people, we're finding high-speed drug-free recovery is possible. Not for everyone, you know, for certain people, certain things will obviously take more time, but it's kind of exciting what we've stumbled across.
Do you find that out of these techniques that there's a certain number of them, maybe a handful of them, that are used or are most effective? Or
that's what we're finding now. Yeah. See, my thinking in the old early times was that it's totally unpredictable what technique is going to work. There's 40 techniques when panic attacks.
Yeah.
When I'm training therapists, I actually have a list of 50 techniques. Some of them don't apply to anxiety. That's why I didn't put them in the book, When Panic Attacks. But, you know, 50, really, probably I use 75 techniques. And I used to teach therapists, you've got to fail as fast as you can. In other words, go from technique to technique to technique, because it's probably going to take 15 or 20 techniques, and you never predict. It might be the downward arrow technique, the cost-benefit analysis, externalization of voices, acceptance paradox, acceptance experimental technique, reattribution, double paradoxical double standard. You know, all these techniques, we never know which one's going to work. Just tell the patient, you know, I don't know which one is going to work, but I know we'll find one that does. And so you fail four or five times each session, and you keep doing that until you come to the technique that works. That was the gospel in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Now what we're finding is that we've learned powerful ways to melt away patients' resistance. Like we've discovered that motivational factors are surprisingly important, more so than I had early considered in my career. And that while depressed patients are suffering and desperately want to get better, there's a way that depressed patients want to hang on to their depression.
Okay.
Similarly with anxiety patients, that there's a sign that someone having panic attacks or obsessive compulsive disorder, whatever it is, phobias, they desperately want to be free of their fears and their anxieties, but there's another side of them that wants to cling to the problem. The same with people with marital problems or relationship problems. They're miserable, but they kind of cling to the conflict, and the same, of course, with addictions. And so what we've developed is to me, amazingly powerful ways of bringing the subconscious resistance to conscious awareness and then melting it away with very powerful but kindly kind of paradoxical therapeutic techniques. And what we've seen is if we melt away the resistance and really empathize with the patient before using any of these techniques, then in most cases, a little core of four or five techniques does it for 90% of the patients.
Wow. You know, many of the people listening to this interview struggle with panic disorder. And in your book, you write that the experimental technique is, in your opinion, the most effective technique for treating panic attacks. Does that still apply now?
Do you still absolutely. Yeah. In fact, a lot of my students at Stanford, young psychiatrists, we have one, Jacob Towery, a wonderful young psychiatrist. He just graduated on Saturday and is opening his practice here in this area. And I showed in one of our recent seminars, and he was there, how you can often cure a panic disorder in a single session using what I call the experimental technique. And he was amazed by it. And then in the next 2 weeks, he had four new patients who had been struggling for years with panic disorder, and every one of them was cured in one session. It takes courage to do the technique. I can briefly describe what it amounts to,
please,
if you like.
Please.
To keep it very simplified, when the inherent in my work and the new forms of therapy is that thoughts create all emotions. You can't be depressed or angry or upset without a thought that triggers that emotion. when people are depressed, they're often telling themselves, I'm worthless, I'm no good, things will never change. That's the key pattern, mental pattern that causes depression. Anxiety, you're telling yourself you're in danger, that something terrible is about to happen. Furthermore, these negative thoughts that cause depression and anxiety are always incorrect thoughts. They're distorted. They're illogical. But you don't know it when you're depressed and anxious. You think these negative thoughts are as valid as the skin on your hands. And so one of the methods we use is to reveal to the patient how what they're telling themselves really isn't true. Now, when patients have panic attacks, there are several kinds of thoughts that are very common. One of the most common is the idea, I'm about to die. Mm-hmm. People from out of the blue, they start getting panicky, hyperventilating, you know, breathing deeply. They get dizzy, the chest gets tight, and they think they're having a heart attack or something, or they're about to have a stroke, they're on the verge of death, and they run off to the emergency room. And then once they get there, they do a check their heart, they check their lungs, say, oh, you're perfectly okay, there's nothing wrong with you. And then 3 days later, they have another panic attack, and they again start thinking they're about to die. Another very common pattern thought that triggers panic attacks is the idea, I'm about to go crazy and lose my mind.
Mm-hmm.
People get kind of upset and dizzy, and maybe there's a conflict in their life they're not dealing with, and they suddenly have this fear, I'm on the verge of insanity. I was treating a young attorney who would have that. He'd be off in a mall shopping with his wife, and he'd suddenly start getting dizzy and panicky and anxious, and he'd think, my gosh, I'm about to crack up. I'm going to end up in a straitjacket. He'd have to make an excuse to leave the mall and go home, and once he was home and feeling safe, you know, the attack would disappear, and then he'd be all kind of ashamed and worried if he's going crazy. So those are the two of the common thinking patterns. Now, when you do the experimental technique, you have a patient do an experiment to test this faulty belief, because you see, it's not true that the patient is about to die. It's not true that the patient is about to go crazy. So one way, let's say if I have a patient who has, during panic attacks, the thought, I'm about to pass out and die and have a heart attack, I will often induce a panic attack in the office with their permission, of mm-hmm. course. And then once they're having a full-blown panic attack and they think, oh my gosh, Dr. Burns, I'm about to die, please, I can't carry on, I need to go to the emergency room or something like that, then I say, now if you were about to die of a heart attack, you're on the verge of a stroke right now, do you think you could do strenuous exercise, aerobic exercises? And they, oh, no, Dr. Burns, if I stand up, I'll pass out. I couldn't possibly do that. And then I persuade them to stand up and start running in place and then doing a jumping jacks. And then say, go harder, bring it on. Let's see if we can dive. Try to cause a heart attack. Jog faster. You know, put your heart into this thing. And then it suddenly dawns on them that they can't bring on a heart attack no matter how hard they try. Mentioned the woman who was cured in the fifth therapy session after 10 years of five horrible panic attacks a week. And she was sobbing at the beginning of the session. I induced the panic attack. She's just certain she's on the verge of death. And she very reluctant got up. She starts jogging in place very slowly. I says, come on, go faster. You got to put your heart into this thing. Let's bring on that heart attack. Jog faster. Do jumping jacks. About 2 minutes into it, she said, I wonder if I could be doing this if I was having a heart attack. And then I said, is this what you see in the emergency rooms of hospitals? Patients with massive heart attacks standing next to their gurneys doing jumping jacks. And when I said that, it dawned on her how ludicrous her thought was, and she started laughing uncontrollably. She bent over. She could barely stand up. She was laughing so hard. And the panic attack was crushed at that moment. That was her moment of recovery.
Yeah.
That 15 seconds ended 10 years of suffering. Now, if a patient thinks they're going crazy during panic attacks, I would have them instead try to go crazy in the office.
Mm.
Or at home, they can do this as well. Induce a panic attack. They think and I say, okay, let's try to go crazy. Roll around on the floor, scream, talk in tongues, whatever you think it would be like to go crazy. And then they say, they do this with great reluctance because they think they really are going to go crazy.
Yeah.
And after, you know, screaming and rolling around on the floor and acting bizarre for a minute or two, they say, Dr. Burns, I just discovered I can't go crazy no matter how hard I try. I've never felt as in control as I do at this moment in my life. And again, that technique, well, every time I've done it, it has ended years, sometimes decades of unsuccessful treatment for panic disorder, agoraphobia, this type of thing.
And what a wonderful sense of freedom.
Oh yeah, it's mind-blowing. It's absolutely fantastic. But for each type of anxiety, you know, there will be a different technique that helps the person. That's why you need a lot of different methods. Now, you know, I know because when I was writing When Panic Attacks, I discovered that I'd had 11 anxiety disorders myself that I'd kind of forgotten about. And so I love treating anxiety because no matter what the person has, I've had that too. I know how much that sucks, and furthermore, I can show you the way out of the woods. I can show you how to be cured of that and quickly if you're willing to pay the price of effective treatment, if you're willing to do what I want you to do to defeat this thing. So, but if it's shyness, there would be other techniques that are amazingly powerful. For obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, other kinds of techniques, and each person will respond to something, you know, a little bit unique and a little bit different. So we need a lot of tools in our toolbox.
You know, that's really interesting, because a lot of the people who would be listening to this would have read my book, Panic Away, and one of the primary techniques I teach people who have panic disorder is to demand that the sensations that they fear to get as bad as it could possibly get. And in fact, to do it in a 21-second countdown. So they count down from 21 to 0, and they've got to have the panic attack in that 21 seconds. And it's the exact same thing. They get this wonderful sense of freedom when they realize there is no threat.
Oh, I'm with you there. And you were so right with that concept in your book, Panic Away. Is that the name of it?
Panic Away, yeah.
Yeah, Panic Away. That's a good title, actually. But I'm the same way. I don't try to get people to control their symptoms or reduce their symptoms. I tell people, I want you to freak out, and let's do it right now. Let's confront the devil you've been running away from since you've been 8 years old, you know, or however long they've been struggling with whatever form of anxiety they have. And it's that moment that you stop running and you surrender to this monster that you discover that the monster has no teeth. And, you know, I've done that with patients with elevator phobias that have been afraid to get on an elevator. I say, let's get in there and freak out together. You know, what are you afraid of? Oh, the walls are going to close in. The air is going to disappear. So I get on the elevator with the patient. I say, feel. I freak out now. Let's feel the walls. They're probably going to crush us at any moment. How anxious are you? The patient says, 70. I say, that's not enough. I want you to get 90, 100% panicky. You know, take a deep breath. The oxygen's probably disappearing, you know. And then pretty soon the patient is in stitches laughing because they realize the absurdity of the thoughts, the fears that have been causing them such shame and such discomfort for you know, long, long periods of time, often since childhood.
And isn't there a good connection between that technique of yours and the acceptance paradox?
Yeah.
Which is also you say it's a very powerful approach.
Yeah. Acceptance, it plays heavy in the treatment of every kind of problem, not just anxiety, but also depression, anger, and there's many different forms of acceptance. But for me personally, acceptance has been a life changer. I think when I grew up, like so many people, I tend to be self-critical and perfectionistic and very demanding on myself, and I just have so many faults and failures in my life, and so for me, acceptance, self-acceptance, has been, you know, a transformational concept. Because I've lowered my standards not from 100% to 80% or 50%, but all the way down to zero.
Wow.
And so everything looks good to me now. and when students criticize me, people in lecture audiences, I don't have to get defensive. I can see the truth in what they're saying and agree with them and see the world through their eyes. And that leads to tremendous warmth and connection with other people. But acceptance is hard to teach. You can write about it or lecture about it, but it's impossible for people to grasp it. It's like trying to describe the Grand Canyon, or it's trying to describe mystical enlightenment. people can't get it. And so what I've done is develop powerful exercises called like the feared fantasy technique, the externalization of voices, where you can actually model acceptance in a powerful, dramatic, and dynamic way with people. And when they see that concept of acceptance and they suddenly grasp the meaning of it, there's no going back. But once you reach that enlightenment, you know, you see a lot of psychotherapy and a lot of spirituality has to do with the death of the ego.
Yeah.
And most religions have attempted to develop rituals to make these concepts accessible to people. As a psychiatrist or doing psychotherapy, I'm also trying to bring these concepts to life for people, but I use secular methods, training methods, role-playing techniques to let people see them for the first time. Once your ego has died, once you've learned to check your ego at the door, there's a tremendous freedom that comes. You're not afraid of criticism. You're not afraid of failure. You feel a great sense of joy. That's what enlightenment is, to my way of thinking. It's the lightening of the spirit. Those heavy burdens of having to be perfect, having to be so special, are taken off of your heart, off of your shoulders, and you suddenly wake up, and you can cry, and you can laugh, and you can experience how amazing it is to be alive, what a gift it is. But then you drift out of enlightenment. After the patient has recovered, I tell them the chance of relapse is 100%. You're going to relapse 1,000 times before you die. And a relapse to me is just 1 minute or more of feeling lousy. You know, suddenly you're back into that perfectionistic trap or that anxious trap or that angry trap. But the cool thing is, once you found the technique that works for you, it will always work for you.
Yeah.
And so then you can climb out of that hole, that black hole you've fallen into, and get back to joy, get back into enlightenment within a minute or an hour or a day or a week. It's okay to be miserable for a few days. We all have to take turns being unhappy. But if you've got the technique that can always get you back into joy and enlightenment, that's kind of what I'm trying to write about in my books, like When Panic Attacks and Feeling Good and the others, and what I'm teaching therapists to do, and the new psychotherapy is very much about how to bring about that enlightenment quickly.
Yeah, I mean, you make a very strong point at the end of the book about relapses, saying that they're guaranteed 100%. You're going to have a relapse. I think that's good for people to know that, so they're aware and they can plan and prepare for it.
Yeah, and then when it comes, you say, "Oh, David, Dr. Burns told me this was going to happen, and he gave me some techniques. I better pull those techniques out and use them again." And I told all my patients, I've always told at the end of therapy, I said, "I've never terminated a patient, and I will. You're my patient for life."
Mm-hmm.
However, you don't want to come back anymore because you're feeling joy and you've got better things to do than spend your time and money, coming to psychotherapy sessions. And that's great. But I want you to know that if you ever have a relapse you can't handle, come on back. And, I'll probably have a canceled session, probably going to see you within 24 hours. And we'll just do the technique that worked for you and get you back out of that. And if I don't hear from you, I'll assume no news is good news. Well, in my whole career, I've had over 35,000 psychotherapy sessions with severely depressed and anxious patients or angry patients too. And I can count on two hands the number of patients who ever came back for relapses out of that, maybe 10 or 12. And in every case, except for one, it was just one or two tune-up sessions, and then they were on their way again.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the long-term prognosis is just fantastic. And one thing that bothers me severely is where drug companies and psychiatrists are being trained to tell depressed and anxious patients, you've got a lifelong disease like diabetes. You're going to have to be on these pills for the rest of your life. You're going to be struggling this for the rest of your life. And I'm a psychiatrist. I can prescribe medications, but I never have kept depressed and anxious patients on long-term medications. And now we're treating almost every, but the vast majority of people without any drugs at all. And to me, the long-term prognosis is just tremendous. But you've got to do that relapse prevention training because it is going to hit. And it might take 3 weeks. It might take 3 hours after recovery before you're suddenly down in the dumps again. And if your therapist hasn't prepared you for that, then the therapist loses credibility because you're going to think, oh, I'm hopeless. The therapy was a fraud. It didn't work. My true self is coming out. And the patient gets so demoralized and some turn to suicide at that moment. So it's incredibly important to do relapse prevention training. And that's why I put that chapter in When Panic Attacks. And I emphasize it always in therapy. And it's made a huge difference.
You know, I was delighted to see how much humor actually plays a role in your therapy sessions. And you've got a couple of humor-based techniques as well in the book that can be very effective for people. Can you tell us about those?
Well, humor, it teaches us something at a deep level. And I love to laugh. And my seminars at Stanford, we spent about a third of our time giggling. And in a good psychotherapy session or a workshop, there's a lot of giggling and laughter as well. Tears, too, can teach us something that's kind of beautiful and deep about life. But some techniques are directly intended to be humorous. Now, for example, one of the many forms of anxiety I've struggled with is called, is shyness, and awkwardness. Mm. I had public speaking anxiety, too, and fear of cameras and television anxiety, all these phobias that I've, grateful to have overcome. But one technique we use is called shame attacking exercises. And I think this was developed by Albert Ellis, the noted and notorious New York psychologist. He mm-hmm. died a few years back, but he was a character and he made a lot of contributions. And when you do a shame attacking exercise, you ask the patient to do something ludicrous in public. The shy patient, because most shy people are terribly afraid, they'll look foolish, they'll make a fool of themselves. And so you have them do that on purpose to get over this fear. But we also have a rule that the therapist has to do it before you're allowed to ask your patients to do shame attacking exercises. And so I've done, tons of them myself, and that I do them with patients, I assign them to patients.
That must be a good laugh.
Yeah, it's fun. You want me to give you a quick example of
that? Do, please, yeah.
I was in New York giving a workshop, actually, for Dr. Ellis's institute, and then in the evening I went out to dinner with several of his colleagues, and we went to this Chinese buffet restaurant where you stand in line, waiting to get the food, and then you go and find a table and sit down. And so there was a long wait because it's such a popular restaurant. And the line snaked around inside of the restaurant. So we were standing in line close to people who were eating dinner. And we were talking, I had just heard about the shame attacking exercises, and I was kind of excited. I'd never heard of it before. And so I was telling him, I think I'm going to use this when I get back to Philadelphia and try it with my shy patients, have them do crazy things in public to get over their fears. And they said, well, that's fine, but we have a rule that then you have to do one yourself first. and then they said, in fact, you can do one right now. And I started to get real anxious because, again, I've struggled with shyness myself. And, mm. And I said, well, gosh, what would I have to do? And they said, well, you could just, why don't you walk up to some table here where people are eating dinner and ask if you can taste their food?
Okay.
And I, oh, my gosh, that's unprofessional. I started making excuses. Oh, that would be inappropriate. And they said, you're just whining and making excuses like patients do. And they said, you can do it. Go do it now. And there were about five of them, and I was under all this social pressure. So I'm really panicking. And so I walk up to this table with six people, and I force myself to say, oh my gosh, that food looks really good. Is it as good as it looks?
I'm getting embarrassed for you.
It's fine, and they didn't offer me any, which. And so I look back, and all these five colleagues are staring at me. The people at the table are staring at me. Are you going to do it or aren't you? Mm. So finally, I just force myself to say, this might sound really bizarre, but do you suppose I could taste that dish right there? And they said, oh, yeah, we have more than we can eat. And they started feeding me this dish. And I said, that's great. And then they said, well, taste this one. It's even better. They started giving me tastes of all their food. And then the people from the institute rushed up and said, can we taste it too? And they started feeding all of us. Everyone was laughing and cracking up. And I realized I'd made a total ass of myself in a public restaurant.
Yeah.
and the world didn't come to an end. In fact, it was kind of fun. Everyone had fun, and they'll have something to talk about. Say, boy, this strange guy, he was dressed in a suit and tie, and he came up and asked to taste our food in the restaurant, and we had this crazy time. And I said, you know, I've been taking myself too seriously.
Yeah.
Life is short. It's okay to do crazy things. And since then, I've done, you know, a lot of crazy shame attacking exercises, and I've enjoyed it, and I get therapists doing it, and we've used it very with amazing effect with shy patients as well. But they've got to do it, you know. They don't want to do it, and it's confronting your fears, and it's always uncomfortable to confront your fears, but that's part of the price of a cure. If you want it change your life, you've got to pay the price.
It's very true. We do take ourselves too seriously. I think we've got to keep that right to be ridiculous.
Yeah, well, that's, I love getting old. I'm going to be 69 years old in about a month or two. And one of the nice things, you get old, you know, you've got to lower your standards. And now I can cry easily. I don't care about making mistakes or looking foolish. And, you know, you kind of get... become more alive, really, when all of this self-critical, perfectionistic stuff begins to blend away, and you can start to connect with people and with yourself on a deeper level, and really experience, you know, the joy of being a human being. And yet, so many people listening to the radio today, they don't know how to do that. They're just making themselves miserable with these distorted, negative thoughts. I'm no good. I'm a loser. You know, inhibited by a lot of fears, and the good news is you can change the way you feel. You don't have to be stuck with that. We have amazingly powerful new techniques.
Well, this has been such an educational call, and I know the listeners will have gotten so much out of this. I think there's such a message of hope there, isn't there? I mean, that this
absolutely
everything is advancing, and the techniques are getting sharper and better, and It's so good for people to hear that they can end this disorder, they can end this problem.
Yeah, and there's research, too, that a lot of people, not everyone, but a lot of people can do it now without a therapist. There have been about 8 controlled outcome studies in the United States, research sponsored by the National Institute of Mental Health, conducted by many researchers, but Forrest Scogan at University of Alabama has done more research like this than anyone. And they said, what would happen if someone has a major depressive episode coming to a medical center for treatment? Instead of giving them drugs or psychotherapy, we just hand them a copy of Dr. Burns's book, Feeling Good.
Mm-hmm.
What would happen to them in the next 4 weeks? And they've discovered that 2/3 of the patients are so improved within 4 weeks of just being given a copy of the book with no other treatment that they don't even need treatment.
Yeah.
And then they've done long-term follow-up on these people as well. How are they 3 years later? And are even better 3 years later than they were at the end of the 4 weeks of what they call bibliotherapy or mm-hmm. reading therapy. And I believe there's been research on anxiety, too, that many, not everybody, but many people can pick up a book like your own Panic Away. Is that
mm-hmm.
the title?
Panic Away, correct.
Panic Away or my own When Panic Attacks, and learn these techniques and use them yourself and have a pretty decent chance of improving or blowing away these fears. I've had to cure a lot of my own fears even before I was a psychiatrist, and so I think the prognosis now is, you know, exceptionally positive.
Isn't that great for people who, you know, might have a fear of visiting a therapist or who don't have access to a therapist, that they could, you know, use a book, they can read through self-help, they can help, you know, heal themselves?
Yes,
it's wonderful.
Yes, I think it's a tremendous thing, and if you look at the outcome literature in the United States, there's actually never been a study with an antidepressant or individual psychotherapy that has shown a two-thirds of patients recovering within 4 weeks.
Wow.
There is no data. And so there is some argument that the reading therapy can be as effective or even more effective for many people than going to an actual therapist. In fact, I've had over 30,000 letters, emails and letters from people who have read Feeling Good and said, I had electroshock therapy for years. I had drug therapy for years. Nothing helped me. I had decades of psychotherapy, and then I bought your book, Feeling Good, and several weeks later I was free of depression. So I think there is strong evidence, anecdotal evidence, and scientific research that self-help for many people can be life-changing. But some people with more severe problems will need the help of a therapist. So we don't want to set up the expectation that, you know, these books are panaceas,
yeah.
But they can be quite life-changing for many people.
Great. Well, I think that's a perfect point to finish the interview on. Thank you very much for taking the time to do this interview. And all of Dr. Burns' books, including When Panic Attacks, are available from most bookstores, or you could easily order them online. And I also recommend our listeners to visit Dr. Burns' site, which is feelinggood.com, to learn more about his work. Dr. Burns, thank you.
Beware, though, that my website is really crummy looking. I have to redo it. You know, it's high on my priority list, so don't be put off by how crude it is. And you might also want to go, we're posting videos now.
Great.
Of, you know, these high-speed techniques, and that website is called teamtherapytraining.com. It's focused on the mental health professional, but we're also going to be hoping to release videos for the general public. But anyone can go there, and you can see little previews and read about these new techniques, teamtherapytraining.com. That might be fun for some people, too. There's a little preview of the videos, and we're showing we have actual videos of actual therapy sessions, high-definition, professionally produced, showing these amazing high-speed techniques.
Great. Well, I know you're going to get a lot of visitors to that. Team therapy training.
One word, teamtherapytraining.com.
Brilliant.
We're calling it now TEAM, team therapy.
Team therapy. Okay.
It's like the next step beyond cognitive therapy, the next evolution, you might say.
Well, again, thank you, Dr. Burns, for doing this interview. I know people will have gotten a hell of a lot out of it.
Thank you, Barry. Have a good day.
You too.